from TCI, this is Enter the Deuce, and I am your host, Patrick Brady. Visiting the Deuce in the hospital was a kind of purgatory. I was able to be near my son, but I couldn't hold him, and touching him through the port in the isolette was a limited activity. I learned how there was a hierarchy in the NICU according to the severity of a child's condition, and just where in that hierarchy the Deuce ranked. Also, I didn't know just how traumatic the ventilator was when we were visiting the NICU. The pandemic has given me a very different perspective, one that deepened my empathy for what Matthew went through. NICU, day 15, off the ventilator. Initially, doctors placed his tininess, the Deuce, on a ventilator because his lung function was so marginal. Even though they used components small enough to put on a G.I. Joe, his head still looked like he was wearing a football face mask sans the helmet. He was anxious, uncomfortable, and though new to the world, not a little pissed off. I think back on how I was once made to feel uncomfortable on my first day of a job, and how quickly I came to detest that job. I couldn't help thinking that the Deuce deserved a better shake than all that plastic. Fortunately, his first big step was demonstrating stronger lungs, and that allowed doctors to replace the ventilator with just oxygen. For a while, the airflow was at 2 atmospheres, which is the breathing equivalent of putting the business end of a blow dryer in your mouth. Eventually, his doctor turned the oxygen down to a single atmosphere before removing the oxygen altogether, less than a week after his birth. Seeing him breathe on his own was quite a relief for us, and it was the first big step, strength-wise, for him. But it has paid another benefit that could easily be underestimated. That's one less piece of equipment attached to him. 3 days later, they removed the O2 line, and then a day after that, pissed off and tired of being pissed off, apologies to Monty Python, he pulled out the feeding tube that ran in his right nostril and down his throat. Can't say I blamed him. I should add here that having all that plastic off him did yield yet another benefit, one not insignificant to his mother or me. We can see his face in full, and damn if he isn't yet another handsome Brady. I'm a cyclist, and to be a cyclist means crashing at some point. It's inevitable. And as any cyclist knows, road rash aids sleep the way the July sun aids an ice cream cone. Not at all. I knew once he was more comfortable, he was going to sleep better. And if there's another thing a cyclist knows, it's that when you're uncomfortable, sleep doesn't come easily, and recovery comes slower. The math on this is simple enough for a baby to understand. Sleep equals recovery. Once the Deuce's face became a tube-free zone, his sleep did improve. In the days since, he has slept more peacefully and for longer periods. That, on occasion, he has slept through my entire visit doesn't bother me a whit. Marine biologists like to say sharks are eating machines. I like to think of the Deuce as a growing machine. The more he sleeps, the more he grows. And nothing else will help him as much as growing will. We've also had reason to be encouraged because the fluid draining from his chest stopped last weekend. I'm told that initially he was producing more than 90 milliliters per day. Now, that's not a lot of fluid in the grand scheme. But coming out of something the size of a house cat, it's a lot. Late last week, he produced only 30 milliliters. Then, over the weekend, he stopped producing any fluid at all. That's progress of an order that encourages his doctors and nurses. Still, his body needs to do some growing and adapting. And the best way for that to happen is if he's draining as little fluid as possible. In my head, I think of how hard it is to stack sandbags at the bank of a river if it is already cresting. If you can start stacking before the river crests, the job is much easier. To help cut the production of those fatty lymphocytes, the doctor has administered a drug called octreotide, which sounds to me like the name of a seagoing dinosaur, or perhaps a spy organization that James Bond needs to foil.
Bond. James Bond.
Mr. Bond, I suppose you wouldn't care to raise the limit?
I have no objection.
Ask a doctor or nurse any question about octreotide, such as, how much do you plan to administer, or how much does a dose cost? And you'll get a curious response. The first thing they tell you is, we don't know how the drug works. Why they all lead with that, and I've heard that statement from 4 doctors and 5 nurses, I can't pretend to know. What I do know is that it does decrease the flow of fatty lymphocytes, and I eventually learned it runs $1,000 per dose. That last detail nearly gave me a panic attack. Because most of the time we're at the hospital, he is asleep, we have pretty narrow roles. Before the ventilator was removed, his sleep was brief and fitful. Helping him relax so that he wasn't so agitated was my one real job. I spent a lot of time reading or writing. At some point, while I was out last weekend, the nurses commented to my wife on just how much time I was spending in the NICU. They told her not only was it unusual for a parent to spend so much time there, it was especially unusual for a dad to spend that much time there. That they'd make any mention of it mystifies me. I'm not doing this for some sort of best dad award from the nurses, and having it mentioned at any level makes me uncomfortable. I'm here because I need to be. That's just my conscience at work. Honestly, I don't know what else to do. Did their opinion of me change when I didn't come for 3 days because I was sick? I don't really care. While we're encouraged with his progress, his situation isn't like with the flu, where once the fever breaks, the outcome is all but assured. The distance he has covered since he was admitted is enormous. Doctors plan to end the octreotide treatment soon. The progress he has made suggests his condition is a football spinning toward goalposts, headed in the right direction. But his condition is also like that football in that unless it passes those goalposts, there's no score. Until the doctors are certain his body has stopped leaking that fluid, he's headed for surgery. And for whatever reason, the likely outcome or how far in the future that necessity might appear, the doctors absolutely refuse to discuss the surgery with me. The one detail I was able to elicit from a pediatric surgeon is that the surgery is difficult. It is difficult because the doohickey in question, his thoracic duct, is hard to find. Even though it functions like a vein or artery, in that it transports a liquid from one part of the body to another, it is filled with a yellow fluid rather than blood, and so it doesn't show off with the distinctive contrast that we see with arteries and veins. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that because this thing runs along the spine, but behind the lungs, a great many small and delicate organs would have to be moved. I think back on the mess I created the last time I emptied the garage in an effort to clean it up and organize it better. I'd never have gotten anything done if I'd been forced to keep everything inside the garage as I worked. What he'd be up against makes the Tower of Hanoi puzzle seem like a light switch. in refusing to discuss the surgery with me. Not whether the deuce needs it or not, but what the surgery would entail in detail. I'm left feeling more frightened of it, more certain that I'll pray to any god, every god, if there's any chance it might eliminate the need for even one scalpel. The enormity of what we're facing comes back in odd and surprising ways. There are details I process and dismiss, if possible. Some just hang in the air unprocessed. On the day Matthew was admitted to the NICU in Downey, when he was still just the deuce, someone gave me a tour of the NICU. I heard how my son would be tended by his own nurse 24/7, how there was a private lactation room for my wife to pump, that there was a special freezer for her milk, how babies leaving the NICU graduate complete with a ceremony in which pomp and circumstance is played. Detail after detail meant to reassure me that he was in a thoroughly superb facility. One detail hangs out there, unable to persuade me that our son is as healthy as they seem to want to convince me. The NICU here is arranged in pods of 6 incubators. The pods are labeled alphabetically, with the healthiest babies, the ones about to graduate and hear pomp and circumstance, are held in pod A. Each successive letter means the case is a bit more serious. Matthew is in pod H. There are only 8 pods. The math isn't hard, is it? Despite the fact that I mostly just sit in one spot and type all day, I'm amazed by how much passes through me, how much I can forget in a day in which so little seemed to happen. Take, for instance, the fact that I said I sit and type all day. I know that leaves out much. How do I know that? Easy. I'm a touch typist. I can type at 100 words per minute if I'm on a roll. Even when I'm thinking deeply, I will still type at more than 30 words per minute. If I was typing all day, I'd be producing well north of 10,000 words per day. And I know my brain is too much of a jumble to manage that. And I have the objective evidence that I'm not producing even half that many words. My sense is that the stress causes me to forget much. Another for instance. One night, the power went out while we were at the hospital. When the outage hit, the lights went out for what seemed like 2, maybe 3 seconds. Then they came back on, as I expected, thanks to the hospital's generators. Filed somewhere in the recesses of my gray matter is a memory that hospitals have generators that will run, at minimum, for 8 hours. I knew this was a part of Southern California Edison's service territory. I knew from having worked in communications for the utilities transmission and distribution business group, they'd have a couple of troublemen on the case in less than an hour. The popped transformer or downed line would be back in operation before our heads hit the pillows. I ceased to think about it by the time we were home. I completely forgot about it until my wife asked one of the nurses about it the next day. Oh yeah, that happened. How did I forget that in less than 10 hours? In an email, a friend shared with me the circumstances of the birth of one of his children, how his wife was taken from him moments after his son was born, and what little the doctor told him included odds of only 50%. As my heart was going out to him in terror, this, despite knowing that he, she, and their sons are all healthy, I flashed on how an infection began in my wife during the late stages of delivery. how she started running a fever, and how we were told the danger threshold was 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Sacred bovines, how do you forget a thing like that? By the time Matthew was delivered, we were in a race to get him out because her temperature had risen to 100.2. No one would tell me just what would happen if she hit the magic number, 100.4. Though, when I asked one nurse, cesarean, she shook her head and said, no, nothing like that. Okay, if not that, then what? I never found out. Doesn't matter. The fever broke. She finished her round of antibiotics. Stuff so powerful it burned her arm as it went in, and she squirmed like a worm on a hot sidewalk. My brain couldn't process the notion that not only was she suffering the worst pain of her life, for the second time, I might add, but her arm was on fire, and from the inside, no less. They might as well have been injecting her with napalm. What I'm left with is a new normal. It's temporary, but anything you do for a month becomes a routine. I'll gradually figure out how to keep up with the email that's burying me. It turns out the Wi-Fi here in the hospital on weekdays is weaker than my infant son. And how to begin catching up on work itself. I've begun a Word doc of the music I can listen to that doesn't make me snivel and wipe my eyes. Turns out, it's a shorter list than I expected. We met with the people in admissions, and they gave us a number, one that describes what we're on the hook for on a per diem basis. It is a sizable number, but not out of line for what you'd spend on a nice vacation. However, now that we are finishing our second full week, that number, once mathed, well, it's just ridiculous for someone who doesn't have a job with three letters beginning with C. We don't have a way to resolve that number yet, but knowing what we're looking at gives me a way to think about what I need to accomplish. It's a bit like planning for a bike race I've never done. At minimum, I need to know how many miles it is and how much climbing there is. That tells me what gears I need, how much food I need, and how many bottles I will drink, the variables that will influence my ability to meet the challenge. There it is again, the bike. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that without the bike, I'd be lost right now. From riding them to melt away the stress, pedal stroke by pedal stroke, to thinking about them as a way not to obsess on my son's care, to all the support I've received from friends, the bike has been a lifeline for me. And how my definition of friend has grown. Naturally, there are all the people I see on the rides. They who may say nothing more than congrats as they ride by. But it has expanded to include all my readers who emailed me and commented at my site, Red Kite Prayer. Anyone who would share something so personal as the successes and losses they've experienced at this fragile entry point of life is a true friend. I'm staggered and amazed by how much I have gained, even as I stare into the abyss at what I might lose. In our next episode, we get a call from the Deuce's doctor informing us we've had a setback in his recovery. Enter the Deuce is a production of the Cycling Independent. Our motto is, if you ride bikes, you're one of us. Find us on the web at cyclingindependent.com or on Facebook at The Cycling Independent. And if you are a cyclist, be sure to check out our other podcasts, The Pace Line, which I co-host with John Lewis, and Revolting, hosted by John Lewis and Steve Knievel of All Hail the Black Market. If you like this independent production and want to show your support, you can stop by The Cycling Independent and subscribe or make a one-time donation. There is a link in our show notes.